Morning. My name's Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am joined today by Alessandra Sitter. Alessandra is a master's student in library and information science at Simmons College and a member of the Boston International Socialist Organization. Thanks for coming on, Alessandra.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to talk to you today about a topic that you addressed in an article in the Socialist Worker last month. The American Library Association amended its Bill of Rights, and it has generated a lot of controversy in the library world. Could you explain that situation before we get into your article and how it responds to it?
Yeah, definitely. So essentially what the American Library Association did was it made a decision at its annual meeting in late June to amend interpretation of the Library Bill of Rights. The Library Bill of Rights is basically the ethical guiding principles of the American Library Association and, by extension, the entirety of the library world in the U.S. So they amended an interpretation of the Library Bill of Rights regarding its meeting room policies. The amendment that was made to explicitly defend the right of hate groups to organize in library meeting rooms. Now, they made this decision on the basis of free speech arguments. Basically, they argued that a publicly funded library is not obligated to provide meeting room space to the public, but if it chooses to do so, it can't discriminate or deny access based on the viewpoints, speakers, or the content of their speech. And they explicitly said, you know, this encompasses religious, political, and hate speech. So the ALA is trying to justify this amendment, one, on legal grounds. They are citing two court cases where white supremacist groups sued libraries in the U.S. in the early 2000s to be able to use those library meeting spaces. But they're also justifying it on the grounds of so-called neutral free speech arguments, which I guess I'll leave there because that's a whole other topic that we are, you know, hopefully going to talk about.
Yeah, and so that brings me to your article for the Socialist Workers, Libraries Can't Afford to Welcome Hate. And you lay out that situation and then open up a discussion around neutrality, what it is supposed to mean now and what it has meant in practice in the past. You have a lot of very interesting things to point out about the political origins of intellectual freedom, which is another one of these words that librarians use to talk about what they're doing as public servant information professionals in a democratic society. What is it and where does it come from?
So intellectual freedom is a fascinating concept and topic, but essentially it's the guiding principle of librarianship in the U.S. as defined by the ALA. You know, it's central to 5 out of the 6 articles of the Library Bill of Rights, and the entirety of the ALA's Library Code of Ethics is devoted to putting those values of intellectual freedom into practice in the profession. And the way that the ALA defines intellectual freedom is within a rights-based framework that's grounded in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and it says that intellectual freedom is there to defend the freedoms of library users to read, seek information, and speak freely, because those things are supposedly integral to fostering a democratic society. But intellectual freedom, because it plays such a central role in the ALA's principles, means that it's not only used to combat issues of censorship. For example, one of the areas that I'm most interested in, its relationship to the ALA's work around equity, diversity, and inclusion. And of course, that those efforts are very important in a workforce that's made up of 98% white workers. But obviously, the ALA has a very broad mandate in fostering a more diverse workforce. But the way that the ALA is going about doing that, because it's based in intellectual freedom, is that the way that they work towards equity, diversity, and inclusion, to say that, you know, as long as everybody in a library community has the intellectual freedom to access and express themselves based on the information they seek, then the library will adequately serve the diverse needs of its patrons. But I think that framework is fundamentally flawed because it assumes that everyone will benefit from the same supports regardless of their societal positionings of race, of class, of gender, sexuality, ability. It reminds me a lot of the All Lives Matter hashtag, which in a really reactionary way claims that Black Lives Matter is anti-white, for example, for calling attention to the systemic devaluation of Black life through frequent police murders of Black people. You also asked where intellectual freedom comes from. That's so important to talk about because even though intellectual freedom is framed as the basis of library neutrality, so to speak, I think it's really critical to remember that the struggle over intellectual freedom came out of the period leading up to the Second World War, when U.S. librarianship saw it as its not only personal but professional duty to take a clear political stance against Hitler's dictatorship and in support of anti-authoritarian values. So intellectual freedom basically arose as a way for librarians to defend their involvement in efforts to oppose fascism. So I think the ALA today, and all of us, would do well to remember that not only is this principle inherently political, but that it has explicitly anti-fascist and anti-Nazi roots that I think their new interpretation of the meeting room policy completely negates.
Which is really interesting because, yeah, you point out that libraries also are taking on racial and other oppression as a problem to address in the material decisions they make about how the library fosters a democratic egalitarian society. And yet, in focusing on this rights-based interpretation of intellectual freedom, it's trying to take this race-blind, color-blind sort of attitude to how the library is used, by whom, and what for.
This amendment is actively ignoring a number of things because it's trapped in this box of librarians. Even though we do take actively political stances and the things that we do and say in the world are inherently political, which the ALA, as you brought up, even like kind of acknowledges in its efforts toward equity, diversity, and inclusion, their interpretation of meeting spaces is ignoring a number of things. You know, one, it's ignoring the fact that allowing white supremacists to meet in the library thereby makes the library an acutely unsafe space for anyone who is part of a group targeted by fascists. So those are the exact people who the ALA is trying to foster equity for in their equity efforts. And the meeting room amendment is also ignoring, like I talked about, the historically anti-fascist stance that libraries and individual librarians have taken, which I think we should talk about more in a little bit. But it also ignores the current political climate in which, you know, far-right neo-Nazi groups in the U.S. are actively emboldened by President Trump and his racist administration. You know, not only have these violent right-wingers been mobilizing more frequently in public demonstration, even most recently this past weekend in Portland, Berkeley, and Providence, Rhode Island, where, you know, luckily they were shut down by anti-fascist activists, but they carried out a string of racist murders and assaults, most notoriously the murder of Heather Heyer last August in Charlottesville, Virginia, and just a few weeks ago, the murder of Nia Wilson in Oakland. So defending the right of white supremacists to meet in the library is not defending their right to speak. It's actually defending their right to kill people who are not, you know, of the glorious white race, as they say.
There's this disconnect between words and actions that is coming from a very abstract place, and we might even say a privileged place, where you don't actually have to think through how some people's words are intimately tied to actions that you might get caught up in.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
You wrote Why Libraries Can't Afford to Welcome Hate for the Socialist Worker, but you also submitted an essay to the Progressive Librarians Guild, and it was awarded their Miriam Braverman Award. Miriam Braverman was a socialist librarian. And in that essay, you talk about a lot of the same subject in more detail, and you advocate for a socio-historically informed model of intellectual freedom. And you also talk about, rather than excluding oppressor-dominant culture, shifting how it appears and functions in the library to recognize its context. What do you mean?
So basically, what I was proposing in that paper was an understanding of intellectual freedom that facilitates the information seeking and expressive behavior of those who have historically faced and currently face systemic oppression under the material and ideological hegemony the U.S. has developed, and by extension in which the profession of U.S. librarianship has developed. And of course, the ultimate goal of that understanding of intellectual freedom would be to dismantle the sources of that oppression. So obviously that understanding is decidedly non-neutral, but it instead takes the position that because dominant ideologies are also not neutral, yet they form the basis of and continue to shape librarianship and the broader historical record, because of that, librarianship in the U.S. should now take a longer view of history and power in order to determine what policies and practices would turn the library into a space that is truly representative of the diversity of opinion and modes of being that exist in our communities and beyond. And you mentioned the shifting, not excluding framework. I want to make really clear that this socio-historical, as I'm calling it, model of intellectual freedom, it doesn't call for library spaces to exclude dominant forms of knowledge from their collections, for example, nor to exclude resources that represent or even endorse systemic forms of oppression, and certainly not to exclude, you know, staff members or patrons who are not of the communities historically marginalized by the U.S. and the profession of librarianship. Instead, it shifts the focus of library spaces away from those entities, and it contextualizes the first two, the resources, the dominant resources, in ways that acknowledge their non-neutrality as upholders of a dominant, if not oppressive, status quo.
And so we can't start to allow government or semi-government entities to start and pick and choose what is allowable. And this is a way of still having an effect on the overall impact of the existence of these materials and persons in library spaces without kind of naturalizing their existence in society.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think what you bring up about, you know, not giving those in power or, you know, the state the ability to decide, like, which groups are able to, you know, speak and not speak, that's really important. That's where I grounded my arguments in a socialist understanding of free speech that recognizes that institutional protocols of restricting or banning speech have been and continue to be used in service of oppressive power structures. You know, that phenomenon has been taking place recently around the U.S. with college and university administrations harshly punishing students for exercising their own right to free speech when protesting far-right speakers like Ann Coulter, like Milo Yiannopoulos, even though those speakers have disproportionately more power in broadcasting their speech through an institutionally sanctioned platform and not to mention generous funding. And, you know, that socialist model of free speech also recognizes that hateful speech isn't going to go away simply if it's banned, right? Because that speech is a symptom of the power structures that uphold the systemic oppressions of our society. So I think the conclusion shouldn't be for the ALA to adopt a position of neutrality, nor a position of banning anybody from the spaces. It means that we all, you know, librarians, patrons, everyone in the community, have to not only expose supremacist groups for using free speech as a cover for organizing hatred and bigotry in order to carry out their violence, with, of course, the aim of violating everyone else's right to free speech. But it should also be a point of organization and mobilization to get everybody out in the streets, outnumber any fascist, any white supremacist groups that come into our cities and show them that their hate is not welcome here.
Well, that's all the time we have for this on-air portion of my conversation with Alessandra Seiter about libraries, free speech, and politics. If you tune into the Old Mole website in a day or two, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, you can hear an extended conversation we have where we continue to talk a bit about actual librarians, political activism, and other ways in which libraries act as a political force for good in our society. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole, Alessandra.
Oh my gosh, it was such a great time to talk to you.
You choose to, you can do your story time. Some people live for reading, some others spend their lives in the stacks. I like living busy with the things I do. Since the social cause of freedom bit me, now I fight the fight.
This is Joe Clement again for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am talking a little bit more with Alessandra Seiter about some things we didn't get to cover on air. Could you, let's talk a bit about actual librarians, actual political activism, but then also the ways in which the ALA has, you know, been complicit in structural and political oppression.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many examples of both of those things. So, you know, going to have to cut it down here. But so, I mean, as a revolutionary socialist and a student of library science, you know, I really believe in the power of libraries to play an important role in the mobilization and the organization of the working class. And like you mentioned, libraries as institutions and individuals have a long history of adding their voices to struggles against oppression in solidarity with the broader community. So one of those examples, if we go back to the 1980s, township libraries in South Africa's Cape Flats played an active role in the struggle against apartheid. They facilitated meetings, covert actions, and political education to assist in the popular movements. And then 3 decades later, the Ferguson Municipal Public Library in Ferguson, Missouri, served a similar purpose, actually, following the police murder of unarmed Black teenager Mike Brown. The library stayed open during the weeks-long protests when so many other businesses and services shuttered their doors. They also provided a space for students when fall school openings were delayed. They helped local businesses apply for government aid, and they offered materials on civil rights and mental health services to facilitate emotional healing. And then, you know, if we go back all the way to the 1960s, after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, discrimination and segregation in U.S. public spaces, including libraries, continued, with several Southern Library Associations refusing membership to Black people. So in that same year, Black librarian E.J. Josey proposed a resolution to the ALA that prevented members of segregated library associations from attending national ALA conferences, which would then decrease their influence on the profession. So the resolution passed successfully, and it effectively ended the you know, de jure segregation of libraries in the U.S. That also ties nicely into what you were saying about the ALA being actively hostile many times to efforts, you know, towards social justice, so to speak. Josey went on to found the Black Caucus in 1969, but the ALA did not consider the group as an affiliate until 1992. And, you know, gosh, there's so much more to say about the ALA not being in solidarity with their own workers. You know, they were anti-communist witch hunts of the late 1940s and 1950s. And the ALA mobilized the concept of intellectual freedom, which we talked about before, to defend themselves from being targeted by the Red Scare. You know, they were using the rationale that providing all points of view, by doing so, libraries could safeguard themselves against those accusations of being a communist. But all points of view didn't include those targeted by McCarthyism, which was demonstrated by the Library of Congress's firing of queer people and anyone with communist sensibilities. ALA also has failed to support librarians when they faced firing and violent ostracization, like librarian T. Ellis Hodgin in 1969. He joined a lawsuit against his daughter's public school for requiring pupils to engage in religious practice, and the ALA did not have anything to say about his persecution. So those are some examples, like you asked.
But then even kind of more structurally to the profession of librarianship, at least in the United States, I like how you kind of mentioned the very classification of certain groups has, you know, reflects a political history that is pretending to not be political.
Can you say more about that?
I'm thinking of how indigenous peoples and their histories are classified not under U.S. history, but in a way that erases their existence as part of the history of this place.
So, yeah, basically classification and cataloging are two fundamental aspects of librarianship. You know, you're organizing information, right? If you want people to find information, you got to organize it. And cataloging and classification is one way to do that. But many frame cataloging and classification as a, you know, completely neutral act, which it definitely is not. If we go back to Library of Congress classification, it places Native American / American Indian materials in the history class between pre-Columbian America and Discovery of America and early explorations. And it separates Native Americans from United States history as a whole. So this classification does a couple of things. One, it reinforces the temporal erasure of indigenous people, and it contextualizes their history as one defined by European colonizers, you know, through the terminology as like discovery that's also used in the classification scheme. Additionally, Library of Congress classification includes subject headings using the term genocide, Holocaust, and massacre when referring to Hitler's extermination of Jews during World War II, as well as other ethnically motivated killing campaigns that are carried out by nations other than the U.S., but it never pairs, you know, the terms genocide, Holocaust, and massacre with the other terms, United States or Canada. So what that does is imply that genocide can only happen outside of the context of North America, which further perpetuates the myth of American exceptionalism. So yes, you're exactly right. That is another way that more structurally librarianship in the U.S. has historically upheld certain forms of oppression.
And to conclude, I just want to talk to you a bit and get your perspective on just, we already talked about some of the ways in which librarians have acted in a political manner that libraries themselves fit into a model of an institution working for the betterment of society as far as including people, increasing representation of oppressed or marginalized peoples. But what other ways do you feel like libraries are, as an institution, you know, carrying a very special role for changing society for the better?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm not convinced that we would even have like a need for libraries as they exist today if we were not if we did not exist in a capitalist society, because everybody would just have access to the resources that they needed. You know, we would have internet, we would have, you know, computers, we would have access to books. So maybe libraries would be around in the sense that they would help us organize and find information, but certainly not to provide services that should just be guaranteed to us. So in that sense, libraries, you're right, are just in their inherent nature existing as a place to get free information in a capitalist society. That is in and of itself a hugely political stance. I have been doing work with a professor at Simmons trying to bridge the digital divide, which of course exists because, you know, less or more than 30 people in the U.S. don't have access to internet at home. So we were doing a program in rural Kansas and rural Maine where libraries would lend people, like they would lend books, they would lend them Wi-Fi hotspots to take home so they could get the internet at home. And that in and of itself is a profoundly political act. If you're saying, hey, we think that everybody should be provided access to technology when, you know, most of the technology happening today is further exacerbating the inequities that already exist in society.
And even beyond that, libraries feeling the pressure to come up with new materials and services to offer have actually been turning to just loaning out all kinds of things. And in a way, there's this vision that's being incubated in libraries of how things could be, where we don't make a bunch of things for individual consumption. We find a way to share them and people can actually have access to useful things.
Yeah, that's right. There's a growing movement called the Library of Things. One great example is the Berkeley Free Library. And they, you know, since the 1970s, I think it is, they've been lending out, you know, tools, cake pans, just about anything you can possibly think of that people don't have, they can't afford in their daily lives, but they still have a need for them.